Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of June 26th, 2017. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a litigation partner at Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, resident in our firm's Houston, Texas office. On Friday, a deeply divided Texas Supreme Court, in a surprising turn of events, disturbed long-standing rules for interpreting mineral conveyances in its 5-4 decision in Wensky v. Ely. There, when the Wenskys bought property in Lavaca County in 1998, the sellers kept for themselves a 1/4 non-participating royalty interest. 5 years later, the Wensky family sold the land to the Elys by way of a deed expressly providing that the sale was subject to the following reservations and exceptions. First, the Wensky's reservation of 3/8 of the minerals and, more critically, the 25% NPRI. Fast forward to 2013, shortly after the Wensky and Ely families had signed mineral leases. It was then that this question arose. Who's responsible for shouldering the NPRI? One would think the answer is obvious. The Elys, naturally, since they explicitly assumed the burden of the NPRI when they bought the land subject to this royalty. Case closed. Notch up another preordained victory for the plain language rule, right? Wrong. At the risk of oversimplifying the rationale for its decision, the Texas Supreme Court held that there was no clear expression by the parties of an intent that the, quote, Ely's interest be the sole interest subject to the NPRI. Accordingly, the court determined that the Wensky and Ely families should share the burden of the NPRI, proportionately to their respective interests in the underlying mineral estate. Thus, the Wenskys would pay 3/8 of the 25% NPRI, and the Elys would pay the remaining 5/8. As a practical matter, what the court seems to be saying is that if one wants the buyer to absorb the full brunt of an NPRI or another existing burden, it's not enough to state that the purchaser is taking the property subject to the NPRI. Rather, now it appears that one would have to take the further step of enunciating that the buyer and the buyer alone is subject to the NPRI. This additional gloss will come as a surprise to many, and it has the potential to open the floodgates to a large volume of new litigation challenging the allocations of royalty burdens among mineral lessors. On this score, Justice Jeff Boyd, in a dissent joined by Justices Willett, Lerman, and Devine, observed that the deed, quote, expressly says that the interest granted to the Elys is the only interest that is subject to the exception for the prior owner's NPRI. Justice Boyd pointed to the chaos that could result from the majority's opinion marginalizing this obvious fact. Here's what he had to say. Quote, when this court adopts a rule of interpretation, parties who draft agreements will reasonably rely on that rule when deciding how to express their intent. Our decisions can imbue words with magic, and drafters rely on that talismanic power to create certainty in their instruments. We should therefore be loath to change long-standing rules in the oil and gas field when doing so would alter the ownership of minerals conveyed in deeds which rely on the law established by this court and followed by lower courts, commentators, and especially lawyers advising their clients. The Wensky court did hedge its bets, however, noting that, quote, we do not hold that all conveyances of a fractional mineral interest subject to an outstanding NPRI will by default result in the various fractional interest owners being proportionately responsible for satisfying the NPRI. This is small solace. Indeed, the decision in Wenske will inject plenty of uncertainty into the mix without providing the clarity of a bright-line rule of construction that would allow oil and gas companies to organize their affairs with confidence. If faced with similar circumstances, an operator in Texas might be wise to obtain stipulations of interest from all involved parties, or otherwise to place in suspense the appropriate amounts until a court can decide which of the operator's lessors is responsible for the outstanding royalty interest. Shifting gears, late last week, the Texas Supreme Court told a cautionary tale for operators with its unanimous opinion in Samson Exploration LLC v. T.S. Reed Properties, Inc., which addressed the circumstance in which a well is situated within not just one pooled unit, but instead within two overlapping units. The operator, Samson Exploration, took it upon itself to pay royalties from the well to interest owners from one of the units to the exclusion of the other. Unsurprisingly, the royalty owners from the second unit who had gone unpaid promptly balked, arguing that although Samson may have struck a poor bargain by including a single well in multiple units, a deal is a deal, and so a sophisticated actor like Samson must sleep in the bed that it made. The Texas Supreme Court, affirming a decision from the Ninth Court of Appeals in Beaumont, sided with the royalty owners. Samson had hung its hat on the principle of property law that title cannot be duplicatively conveyed. Taking this tenet, together with the rule that a pooled unit is invalid unless title is cross-conveyed, Samson reasoned that the second unit never even came into existence, thereby relieving it of any obligation to pay royalties. Justice Guzman, writing for the undivided court, did not mince words when, in response, she bluntly announced that, quote, Samson's argument in this case is a theoretical construct that holds no water, end quote. Elaborating, Justice Guzman emphasized that the strictures of property law do not alone control the issue. Quote, under the law in Texas, pooling implicates both contract and property law. Authority to pool emanates from contract, but pooling agreements give rise to interests in realty. End quote. Owing to this duality, the Supreme Court, quote, discerned no impediment to enforcing Samson's obligations in this case under a contract theory, even if the pooling designation failed to effect a conveyance of title. While the court had already made itself abundantly clear, it drove its point even further home when it proceeded to invoke the words of a 1968 decision from the Fifth Circuit, Howell v. Union Producing Company, reported at 392 Fed Second 95. Quote, to argue that we must enforce only reasonable contracts, or contracts which reasonable men enter into, mistakes our function. We can and do enforce unreasonable contracts if they be clear. Unreasonable men make reasonable contracts, and reasonable men may make unreasonable contracts. In short, the court concluded, quote, though Samson bemoans the economic consequence of its actions, this is a circumstance of Samson's own making, end quote. Finally this week, we turn to an important verdict out of the state of Arkansas, where Southwestern Energy convinced a jury that the company had not underpaid mineral lessors by using Southwestern affiliates to process gas produced from their leases. The trial of a class action with thousands of members, where the alleged damages were in excess of $100 million, lasted a full 10 days. The members of the jury were charged with evaluating the plaintiff's allegations that Southwestern's use of affiliates constitutes a form of fraud, and also violates the terms of their mineral leases because it allows the affiliates to realize a profit while skimming away money from royalty owners through unreasonable expenses. The problem with the plaintiff's basic theory of the case, however, is that it reflexively assumes that the use of an affiliate is inherently improper, and thus that the affiliate's rates, whatever they might be, are unreasonable and in violation of the lease. But this ignores the simple reality that an affiliate's rates can easily be in the same ballpark as those charged by unaffiliated third parties. And naturally, the operator has to hire someone, whether it's an affiliate or not, to conduct post-production activities. After all, the work isn't going to just happen magically on its own, nor is anyone going to do the work for free. As it turns out, according to the jury's findings, the fees charged by the affiliate to Southwestern were within the range of rates charged by gathering companies in comparable basins, such as the Barnett Shale in Texas and the San Juan Basin in the southwestern United States. Since the deductions taken by Southwestern for post-production processing were akin to the prevailing market rates, the jury found that the rates were necessarily reasonable and were not an attempt by the operator to exploit an affiliate relationship as a means of surreptitiously draining dollars from royalty owners. Unfortunately for the industry, the allegations in this case are not unique. Plaintiffs in many oil and gas-producing jurisdictions are targeting the deduction of post-production fees, even when the underlying mineral leases allow for the deduction of such expenses, and even in the absence of clauses expressly barring the use of affiliates. In these cases, the rather insidious and frankly baseless allegation is that the use of an affiliate to process gas is, almost by definition, impermissible. While allegations like these offend common sense and ignore commercial and market realities, until we see the courts put the argument to bed with a bright-line rule, operators may still be forced to fend off these kinds of meritless allegations through expensive summary judgment practice, and perhaps even by way of a full-stroke trial.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.